more affecting than anything we shared with them. Damn. It's as layered as an onion, one strangeness on another. For half an hour, they sat in the car, in the airport parking lot, talking. Outside, cars and pickups came and went around them, and the January wind buffeted the Chevy and moaned at the windows. However, they were seldom aware of anything but each other. She told him about her fugues, the hypnotic regression sessions with Pablo Jackson, and the mind control technique known as the Azrael Block. She told him about Pablo's murder and her own narrow escape. Although clearly, Ginger sought neither sympathy for her suffering nor praise for the way she had handled herself in trying circumstances, Dom's respect and admiration for her grew by the minute. She was only 5'2", 100 pounds, but somehow she had a physical presence more imposing than many men, twice her size. Dom recounted the events of the past 24 hours, and when Ginger heard about his dream of the previous night, and about the new memories that surfaced in it, she appeared immensely relieved. In Dom's dream, there was proof of Pablo Jackson's theory. Her fugues were not caused by mental aberration, they were instead always triggered by objects associated with her imprisonment at the motel 2 summers ago. The black gloves and dark visored helmet had terrified her because they made a direct connection with the repressed memories of the people in decontamination suits who tended her while she underwent brainwashing. The drain in the hospital scrub sink threw the panic switch because she probably had been one of those detainees poisoned by Colonel Falkirk, whoever the hell he was, then forced to vomit up the deadly substance just as Dom had been. While strapped in the motel bed, she must have undergone many eye examinations to determine the depth of her drug-induced trance, which was why an ophthalmoscope had sent her reeling away in a dark terror that night in George Hannaby's office. Dom saw a relaxation of the tension at this irrefutable evidence that her blackouts were not a sign of madness, and were, in fact, a desperate but entirely rational method of avoiding the repressed memories that the mind control experts had forbidden her to recall. She said, "But what about the brass buttons on the coat of the man who killed Pablo, and on the policeman's uniform? Why did they terrify me and throw me into a fugue?" "We know the military is involved in this cover-up," Dom said, turning up the heater to counteract the cold air pouring off the car's wind-buffeted windows. "And officers' uniforms have brass buttons like that, though not a lion passant. Most likely, raised images of eagles. The buttons on the killers' and cops' coats were probably similar to the buttons on the uniforms of those who imprisoned us in the motel."
"Okay. But you said they wore decontamination suits, not uniforms."
"Maybe they didn't wear the decon suits for the entire 3.5 days. At some point, they decided it was safe to take them off." She nodded.
"I'm sure that's right. Which leaves only one thing. Those carriage lamps behind the house on Newbury Street, the day Pablo was murdered, I told you about them. Black iron with pebbled amber panes of glass. They had those bulbs that flickered like a gas flame. Perfectly innocent lamps, but they kicked me into another blackout."
"The bases of the lamps in the rooms at the Tranquility Motel are designed like hurricane lamps, with little windows of amber glass."
"I'll be damned. So every blackout was triggered by an object that reminded me of something from those days when I was being brainwashed."
Dom hesitated, then reached inside his sweater and withdrew the Polaroid photograph from his shirt pocket and handed it to her. She paled and shuddered when she saw herself staring up with vacant eyes at the camera.
"Gefault!"
She looked away from the picture. Dom gave her time to recover from the shock of the snapshot. Outside, in the fading, dirty gray light, a score of vehicles waited silently like dark, dumb, brooding beasts. The wind harried collections of litter, dead leaves, and miscellaneous debris across the macadam.
"It's Meshuggah," she said,
lowering her troubled gaze to the photo again.
"It's crazy. What could possibly have happened to us that would justify this elaborate, risky conspiracy? What did we have seen that was so dreadfully goddamned important?
We'll find out, he promised.
Will we? Will they let us? They killed Pablo. Won't they do whatever's necessary to keep us from uncovering the truth?
Adjusting the heater again, Dom said, Well, I figure there are two factions among the conspirators. There are the hard asses, represented by Colonel Falkirk and his people, and the better guys. Can't call them good guys, exactly. Represented by the fellow who sent us these snapshots, and by the two men in decontamination suits in my dream last night. The hard asses wanted to kill all of us right at the start, so there'd never be any doubt that the cover-up would be permanent. But the better guys wanted to scrub our memories, use mind control techniques instead of violence so we could go on living. And the better guys must be the stronger of the two factions because they got their way.
The gunman who killed Pablo was most likely one of the hard asses.
Yeah, working for Falkirk. The colonel's evidently still willing to kill anyone who jeopardizes the cover-up, which means none of us is safe. But there's the other faction that doesn't believe in Falkirk's ultimate solution, and they're still trying to protect us, I think. So we have a chance. Anyway, we can't walk away. We can't go home and try to get on with our lives just because the enemy looks formidable.
No, Ginger agreed, we can't. Because until we find out what happened, we don't really have lives to get on with.
The wind blew withered leaves against the windshield, over the roof. Ginger swept the parking lot with her gaze.
They must know we're gathering at the motel, that things are falling apart. Do you think they're watching us now?
Very likely they've got the motel under surveillance, Dom said. But no one followed me to the airport. I watched for a tail.
They wouldn't need to tail you here, she said grimly. They knew where you were going. They knew who you were picking up.
Are we laboring under a delusion of free will? Are we only bugs on a giant's palm, and can the giant crush us whenever he wants?
Maybe, Ginger Weiss said. But by God, we can at least give him a couple of nasty bites before he smashes us.
She spoke with a fierce determination that was convincing, but also amusing in the context of a metaphor as basically comic as a giant and a bunch of bugs. Though he was pleased by her fierce resolution in the face of such overwhelmingly poor odds, Dom could not help laughing. Blinking at him in surprise, she laughed, too.
Hey, am I spunky or what?
Might be smashed by a giant, but I feel triumphant, 'cause I'll be able to bite him just before he reduces me to a bloody smear. Spunky should be your middle name, Dom agreed, laughing harder. As he watched Ginger laughing at her own expense, Dom was again stricken by her beauty. His response to her, on seeing her disembark from the plane, had been instant and powerful because of unremembered experiences they shared. But even if they had been complete strangers whose lives had never crossed, he would have felt something more at the sight of her than he felt when he saw other beautiful women. Under any circumstances, she would have turned his head. She was special. He drew a deep breath.
Shall I take you to meet the others?
Oh, yes, she said, dabbing her slender fingers at the corners of her eyes to wipe away tears that her graveyard laughter had occasioned.
Yes. Oh, I'm eager to meet them. The other bugs on the giant's hand.
Less than half an hour before nightfall, the shadows on the high plains were long, and the muddy, gray light of the overcast dusk lent an air of mystery even to such ordinary objects as clumps of sagebrush, rock formations, and twisted mounds of dead, brown bunch grass. Before taking her to the motel, Dom Corvaces had brought Ginger to what he called the special place, more than 200 yards south of Interstate 80. The wind-rustled half-seen vegetation. The ice on the grass and sagebrush, when glimpsed at all, looked black, shiny black. The writer stood away from her, hands jammed in his jacket pockets, silent.
He had told her that he did not want to influence her reaction to the place, or color her first feelings with a description of his own. Ginger wandered slowly back and forth, feeling slightly foolish, as if taking part in a half-baked experiment in psychic perception, seeking clairvoyant vibrations. But she quickly stopped feeling foolish when the vibrations actually began to shake her. A queer uneasiness arose, and she found herself staying away from the deeper pockets of shadows, as if something hostile lurked in them. Her heart pounded. Uneasiness became fear, and she heard the tempo of her breathing change.
"It's inside me. It's inside me."
She whirled toward that voice. It was Dom's voice, but it had not come from him. The words had been spoken behind her, but no one was there. Only dry sagebrush and a thin patch of snow glowing softly, luminously, within a nest of shadows. "What's the matter?" Dom asked, moving toward her. She was wrong. Dom's other voice, the ghostly-sounding voice, had not come from behind her. It had come from within her. She heard that other Dom again, and she realized she was hearing a fragment of memory, an echo from the past, something he had said to her that Friday night, July 6th, perhaps when they had both stood in this same place. The scrap of memory came with no visual or olfactory element because it was part of the events locked behind the Azrael block. There were just those three urgent words repeated twice.
"It's inside me. It's inside me."
Abruptly, her simmering fear flashed bright. The landscape around her seemed to embody a nameless but monstrous threat. She started back toward the highway, walking fast, and Dom asked what was wrong, and she walked even faster, unable to answer because fear was like a paste in her mouth and throat. He called her name, and she began to run. Every object in sight seemed to have been wounded on its eastern flank, for black blood shadows spilled in that direction. She was not able to speak until they were back in the Chevy, with the doors locked, the engine running, and the heater blowing warm air on her chilled face. Shakily, she told him about the nameless threat she had felt on that ordinary-looking piece of ground, and about the memory of his urgent voice and the three-word sentence.
"It's inside me," he said thoughtfully.
"You're sure it's really something I said to you that night?"
"Yes,"
she shivered.
"It's inside me. What in the world did I mean by that?"
"I don't know," Ginger said, "but it gives me the creeps."
He was silent a moment, then he said,
"Yeah, me too."
That evening, at the motel, Ginger Weiss felt almost as if she was with her family on a holiday gathering like Thanksgiving. In spite of the difficulties in which they found themselves, their spirits were high, for in the manner of a real family they drew strength from one another. The six of them crowded into the kitchen and prepared dinner together, and through that domestic labor Ginger got to know the others better and felt a strengthening of the ties that bound her to them. Ned Sarver, being a professional cook, prepared the main dish, chicken breasts baked in a spicy green tomatillo sauce with sour cream. Initially, Ginger mistakenly thought Ned was a brooding, unfriendly sort, but she soon changed her opinion. Taciturnity sometimes could be a sign of a healthy ego that did not require constant gratification, which was the case with Ned. Besides, Ginger could not help but like a man who loved his wife as deeply as Ned loved Sandy, a love apparent in every word he spoke to her, in every glance he cast her way. Sandy, the only one of them to be affected only positively by their mysterious ordeal, was so sweet-tempered, so delighted with the recent changes in herself that she was especially good company. Together, she and Ginger prepared the dinner salad and vegetables, and as they worked, an almost sisterly affection developed between them. Fay Block made the dessert, a refrigerator pie with a chocolate crust and banana cream filling. Ginger liked Fay, who reminded her of Rita Hannaby. That cultured society woman was different from Fay in many ways, but in fundamental respects they were alike. efficient, take-charge types, tough of mind, tender of spirit. Ernie Bloch and Dom Corvaces put the extra leaf in the table and arranged six place settings. Ernie had seemed gruff and intimidating at first, but now she saw he was a sweetheart. He inspired much affection because of his fear of darkness, which made him seem boyish in spite of his size and age. Of the five people among whom Ginger found herself, only Dominic Corvaces stirred emotions that she could not understand. For him, she felt the same friendship that she felt for the others, and she was aware of a special bond between them related to an unremembered experience just the two of them had shared. But she was also sexually attracted to him. That surprised her, because she never felt desire for a man until she knew him for several weeks, at least, and knew him well. Wary of her romantic yearnings, Ginger kept a tight rein on her emotions, and she tried hard to convince herself that Dom did not feel a similar attraction for her, which he so patently did. Through dinner, the six of them continued to discuss their strange predicament and search for clues that might have been overlooked. Like Dom, Ginger had no recollection of the toxic spill 2 years ago, though the Blocks and Sarvers recalled it clearly. I-80 had really been closed, and an environmental emergency had been declared. There was no doubt about that much. Last night, however, Dom convinced the Blocks that their memories of evacuating to Elroy and Nancy Jameson's mountain ranch were phony, and that both they and the Jamesons had almost surely been kept at the motel. According to Faye and Ernie, the Jamesons had not mentioned having any nightmares or odd problems lately, so their brainwashing must have been effective, though it would be necessary to talk to them soon. Likewise, Ned and Sandy had reluctantly concluded that their own recollections of sitting out the crisis at their trailer were too shallow to be real, and that they had been strapped into motel beds, drugged, and brainwashed like everyone else in those Polaroids.
But, Faye wondered, why wouldn't they give us all approximately the same false memories?
Ginger said, maybe all you locals have had the toxic spill and the highway closure woven into your false memories. That'd be necessary because later people would be asking you where you went during the emergency, and you'd have to know what they were talking about. But Dom and I are from distant places, unlikely ever to return, unlikely to run into anyone who would know that we'd been within the quarantine zone. So they didn't bother including that bit of reality in the set of fake memories they gave us.
Sandy paused with a morsel of chicken on her fork.
But wouldn't it be safer and easier to make your memories fit the toxic spill, too?
Ever since Pablo Jackson helped me discover that my mind had been tampered with, Ginger said, I've been reading about brainwashing, and I think maybe it's a lot less difficult to implant recollections that are entirely false than it is to weave in threads of reality such as the environmental emergency and the road closure. It probably takes a lot longer to construct fake memories that have some reality to them, and maybe they simply didn't have time to do that with all of us. So they gave the super deluxe brainwashing job only to you locals.
That feels like the truth, Ernie said,
and everyone agreed. Faye said,
but did the toxic spill really happen, or was it just the cover story that gave them an excuse to close I-80 and bottle us up, a way of preventing us from talking about what we had seen Friday night?
I suspect there was contamination of some sort, Ginger said. In Dom's nightmare, which we know is really more memory than dream, those men were wearing decontamination suits. Now, when they came into the quarantine zone, maybe they'd wear costumes like that for the benefit of newsmen or other onlookers, but once here, where only we could see them, they wouldn't keep the suits on unless they absolutely had to.
Glancing uneasily at the blind-covered window nearest the table, as if he thought he had seen a trickle of darkness dribbling in from the night beyond, Ernie cleared his throat and said,
Well, which was it, do you think? You're the doctor. Does it sound like chemical or biological contamination? The story they gave the media was that it involved chemicals being delivered to Shankfield's testing facilities.
Ginger had been thinking about this question for some time, long before Ernie asked it. Chemical or biological contamination? She had arrived at an answer that deeply disturbed her.
Generally speaking, the suits required for a chemical spill don't have to be airtight. They just have to cover the worker from head to toe in order to prevent any caustic or toxic substance from coming into contact with his skin. And they have to include a respirator, rather like a scuba diver's tank and mask, so he won't breathe deadly fumes. They're usually made of lightweight, non-porous cloth, and the headgear consists of a simple cloth hood with a plastic visor. But Don described heavy-looking suits, with an outer level of thick vinyl, with gloves that were of one piece with the sleeves and a hard helmet that locked into an airtight seal at the collar. That is unquestionably gear that's been designed to prevent exposure to a dangerous biological agent. Microbes. For a while, no one said a word, pondering this disquieting news. Then Ned took a long swallow of his Heineken for fortification and said,
"So we must have been infected with something."
Faye said, "Some virus they developed for biological warfare."
"If it was headed for Schenkfield, that's the only kind of bug it could have been," Ernie said. "Something mean."
"Yet we lived," Sandy said. "Because they were immediately able to quarantine us and treat us," Ginger said. "Surely they wouldn't be intending to test a genetically engineered virus, some new and deadly organism that could be used as a weapon, unless they had simultaneously developed an effective cure for it. So they had a supply of a new antibiotic or serum to guard against just such an accident. If they contaminated us, they also cured us."
Ernie said,
"It sounds right, doesn't it? Maybe it's all starting to fall together, piece by piece."
Dom disagreed.
"It still doesn't explain what happened on that Friday night. What we saw that they didn't want us to see. It doesn't explain what made the whole damn diner shake, or what blew out the windows either on that first night or again last night."
"And it doesn't explain the other weird stuff," Faye said. "Like all those paper moons whirling around Dom and Lomax's house? Or Father Vikazik's claim that this young priest's been performing miracle cures?"
They looked at one another, waiting in silence for someone to put forth an explanation that would tie biological contamination with those paranormal events. But no one had an answer. Less than 300 miles west of the Tranquility Motel, in another motel in Reno, Brendan Cronin had gone to bed and turned out the lights. Although it was only a few minutes after 9 o'clock, he was still functioning on Chicago time, so for him it was after 11. However, sleep eluded him. After checking into the motel and having dinner at a nearby Bob's Big Boy, he had telephoned St. Bet's Rectory and had spoken with Father Vikazik, who had told him of the call from Dominic Corvaces. Brendan was electrified by the news that he was not the only one caught up in this mystery. He considered calling the Tranquility, but they already knew he was on his way, and whatever they could say on the phone could be said better in person tomorrow. Thoughts of tomorrow and speculations about what might happen were what kept sleep at bay. He had lain awake less than an hour, and his thoughts had drifted to the eerie luminescence that had filled his rectory bedroom 2 nights ago, when suddenly that phenomenon appeared once more. This time, there was no visible source of light, not even one so unlikely as the frost moon upon the window from which the uncanny radiance had sprung last Friday night. Now, the glow appeared above him and on all sides, as if the very molecules of the air had acquired the ability to produce light. It was a lunar, pale, milky shimmer at first, growing brighter by the second, until it seemed as if he must be lying in an open field, under the looming countenance of a full moon. This was different from the peaceful golden light that was featured in his recurring dream, and as it had done 2 nights ago, it filled him with conflicting emotions. Horror and rapture, fear and wild excitement. As in his rectory bedroom, the lactescent light changed color, darkening to scarlet. He seemed suspended in a radiant bubble of blood. "It's inside me," he thought, wondering what that meant. "Inside me." The thought reverberated in his mind. Suddenly he was cold with fear. His thundering heart seemed about to explode. He lay rigid. In his hands the rings appeared, throbbing. 2. Monday, January 13th. When they gathered in Ernie and Faye's kitchen for breakfast the next morning, Dom was excited to learn that the previous night had been an ordeal for most of them. "It's unraveling the way I hoped it might," he said. "By gathering together here, by recreating the group that was gathered here that night, and by working together to get at the truth, we're putting constant pressure on the memory blocks that have been implanted in us. And now that barrier is crumbling a bit faster." Last night, Dom, Ginger, Ernie, and Ned experienced exceptionally vivid nightmares of such similarity that they were surely fragments of forbidden memories. In every case, they had involved being strapped to motel beds and tended by men in decontamination suits. Sandy had a pleasant dream, although it lacked the clarity and detail of the others' nightmares. Faye was the only one who did not dream at all. Ned had been so disturbed by his nightmare that on Monday morning, when he and Sandy arrived from Beowawe for breakfast, he announced they were moving into a room at the motel for the duration. "During the night, after the dream woke me, I couldn't get back to sleep. And while I was laying there, I got to thinking how lonely it is at our trailer. Empty plains all around. Maybe this Colonel Falkirk will decide to kill us like he wanted to do in the first place. And if he comes for us, I don't want me and Sandy to be alone out there at the trailer." Dom sympathized with Ned because these dark and vivid dreams were new to the cook. Over recent weeks, Dom, Ginger, and Ernie had learned a little about coping with the frighteningly powerful nightmares, but Ned had developed no armor, so he was badly shaken. And of course, Ned was well advised to fear Falkirk. The closer they came to exposing the conspiracy and learning the truth, the more likely they were to become targets of a preemptive strike. Dom did not think Falkirk would make a move until Brendan Cronin, Georgia Monotella, and perhaps other victims had gathered at the Tranquility. But once they were in one place, they would need to be prepared for trouble. Now, in the block's kitchen, Ned Sarver picked at his breakfast without appetite as he spoke of the images that had disturbed his sleep. At first, he had dreamed of being held prisoner by men in decontamination suits, but later they had worn either lab coats or military uniforms, an indication that the biological danger had passed. One of the uniformed men had been Colonel Falkirk, and Ned described that officer in detail, about 50 years old, black hair graying at the temples, gray eyes like circles of polished steel, a beakish nose, thin lips. Ernie was able to confirm the word portrait that Ned painted, for Falkirk had also been in his nightmare. The amazing coincidence of the same man appearing in both Ned's and Ernie's dreams made it clear that his face was not merely a figment of imagination, but a memory of a real face that both Ernie and Ned had seen 2 summers ago.
"And in my nightmare," Ernie said, "another army officer referred to Falkirk by his first name, Leland. Colonel Leland Falkirk."
"He's probably stationed at Schenkfield," Ginger said.
"We'll try to find out later," Dom said.
The barriers to memory were definitely crumbling. That prospect boosted Dom's spirits higher than they had been in months. In Ginger's nightmare, which she recounted for them, she had not been the only person being brainwashed in Room 5, the room she had occupied that summer and which she now occupied again.
"There was a rollaway bed in one corner, and the redhead in it was someone I'd never seen before. She was about 40 years old. They had her connected to her own IV drip and EKG machine. She had that vacant stare."
Just as Ernie and Ned had shared a new development, the appearance of Colonel Falkirk in their nightmares, Dom and Ginger had shared this other discovery. In Dom's dream,
There had been a rollaway bed, flanked by an IV stand and an EKG monitor, and in the bed had been a young man in his 20s with a pale face, bushy mustache, and zombie eyes.
"What does it mean?" Fayblok asked. "Did they have so many subjects for brainwashing that they more than filled all 20 rooms?" "But," Sandy said, "the registry showed only 11 rooms rented."
Ginger said,
"There must have been people on the interstate, in transit, who saw what we saw. The army managed to stop them and bring them here. None of their names would appear on the registry."
"How many?" Fay wondered.
"We'll probably never know for sure," Dom said. "We never actually met them. We only shared rooms with them while we were drugged. We might eventually remember the faces of those we saw, but we can't possibly remember names and addresses we never knew in the first place. But at least those reprogrammed memories, those tissues of lies, were dissolving, allowing the truth to show through." Dom was grateful for that much. In time, they would uncover the entire story, if Colonel Falkirk did not first come after them with heavy artillery. Monday morning, while the group at the Tranquility ate breakfast, Jack Twist was being escorted to a safe deposit box in a vault of a Fifth Avenue branch of Citibank in New York. The attending bank employee, an attractive young woman, kept calling him Mr. Farnham, for that was the false identity under which he had acquired the box. After they used their separate keys to remove the box from the wall of the vault, when he was alone with it in a cubicle, he opened the lid and stared in shock at the contents. The rectangular metal container held something that he had not put there, which was an impossibility, since only he knew about the box and possessed the only master key. It should have contained 5 white envelopes, each filled with $5,000 in $100 and $20 bills, and indeed that money appeared to be untouched. This was one of 11 emergency caches he kept in safe deposit boxes all over the city. He had set out this morning to remove $15,000 from each, a total of $165,000, which he intended to give away. He opened each of the 5 envelopes and counted the contents with trembling hands. Not a single bill was missing. Jack was not even slightly relieved. Though his money was still there, the presence of the other object proved that his false identity had been penetrated, his privacy violated, and his freedom jeopardized. Someone knew who Gregory Farnham really was, and the item that had been left in the box was a bold notification that his elaborately constructed cover had been penetrated. It was a postcard. There was no writing on the back, no message. The presence of the card itself was message enough. On the front was a photograph of the Tranquility Motel. The summer before last, after he and Branch Pollard and a third man had burglarized the Averill McAllister estate in Marin County, north of San Francisco, and after Jack paid a profitable visit to Reno, he rented a car and drove east, stopping the first night at the Tranquility Motel along Interstate 80. He had not thought about the place since, but he recognized it the instant he saw the photograph. Who could possibly know he had stayed at that motel? Not Branch Pollard. He had never told Branch about Reno or about his decision to drive back to New York. And not the third man on the McAllister job, a guy named Sal Finrow from Los Angeles. Jack had never seen him again after they had split the take from that sour job. Then Jack realized that at least 3 of his phony IDs had been penetrated. He rented this safe deposit box as Farnham, but he stayed at the Tranquility Motel as Thornton Wainwright. Both noms de guerre were now blown, and the only way anyone could have linked them was by connecting Jack with his Philippe Delon identity, under which he resided at his Fifth Avenue apartment, so that name was blown as well. Jesus. He sat in the bank cubicle, stunned, but thinking furiously, trying to decide who his enemy might be. It could not be the police, or the FBI, or any other legitimate authority. for they would simply have arrested him once they had accumulated this much evidence. They would not play games. Nor could it be any of the men with whom he ever worked on a heist, for he took great care to keep his acquaintances in the criminal underworld well out of his life on Fifth Avenue. None of them knew where he really lived. In the event they scouted a job requiring his planning skills and special knowledge, they could reach him only through a series of mail drops or through a chain of pseudonymously listed phone numbers backed up by answering machines. He was confident of the effectiveness of those precautions. Besides, if some hoodlum had gotten into this box, he would not have left the $25,000 untouched. He would have taken every dollar of it. So who's on to me? Jack wondered. He focused on the Fratellanza warehouse robbery that he and Mort and Tommy Sung had pulled off December 3rd. Was the Mafia after him? When they wanted to find someone, those boys had more contacts, sources, determination, and sheer perseverance than the FBI. And the Fratellanza would most likely not have taken the $25,000, leaving it as an ominous notice that they wanted more than the money he had stolen from them. It was also in character for the Fratellanza to leave a teaser like the postcard, because those guys enjoyed making a target sweat a lot before they finally pulled the trigger. On the other hand, even if the mob tracked him down, then somehow searched back through his criminal career to see who else he had hit, they would not have gone to the trouble of acquiring cards from the Tranquility Motel just to put the fear of God in him. If they had wanted to leave an upsetting teaser in the safe deposit box, they would have left a photo of the warehouse that he had robbed in New Jersey. So it was not the Mafia. Then who? Damn it, who? The tiny cubicle began to seem even smaller than it was. Jack felt claustrophobic and vulnerable. As long as he was in the bank, there was nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. He stuffed the $25,000 into his overcoat pockets, no longer intending to give away any of it. Suddenly, it had become his escape money. He put the postcard in his wallet, closed the empty box, and rang the buzzer for the attendant. 2 minutes later, he was outside, drawing deep breaths of the freezing January air, studying the people on Fifth Avenue for one who might be tailing him. He saw no one suspicious. For a moment he stood rock-like in the river of people that flowed around him. He wanted to get out of the city and the state as quickly as possible, flee to an unlikely destination where they would not look for him, whoever they were. Yet he was not entirely sure that flight was necessary. In ranger training, he had been taught never to act until he understood why he was acting and until he knew what he hoped to achieve by his actions. Besides, fear of his faceless enemy was outweighed by curiosity. He needed to know who he was up against, how they had broken his various covers, and what they wanted from him. Outside the Citibank building, Jack hailed a cab and went to the corner of Wall Street and William Street, in the heart of the financial district, where he had 6 safe deposit boxes in 6 banks. He went to 5 of them, from each of which he collected $25,000 and a postcard of the Tranquility Motel. He decided to stop after the 5th, because his coat pockets were already bulging with $125,000, a sufficiently dangerous sum to be carrying, and because by now he knew beyond a doubt that his other 6 phony identities and clandestine safe deposit boxes had been found out as well. He had enough money with which to travel, and he was not particularly worried about leaving the remaining $150,000 in the other 6 boxes. For one thing, Jack had $4 million in his Swiss accounts, and for another thing, the distributor of the postcards would already have taken the available money if that had been his intention. By now, he'd had time to think about that motel out in Nevada. And he had begun to realize something was strange about the time that he had spent at the place. He had remained there for 3 days, relaxing, enjoying the quiet and the scenery. But now, for the first time, it seemed to him that he would have done no such thing. Not with so much cash in the trunk of his rental car. Not when he had already been away from New York and Jenny for 2 weeks. He would have driven straight home from Reno. Now that he was forced to contemplate it, the 3-day stay at the Tranquility Motel did not make much sense. Another taxi conveyed him to his Fifth Avenue apartment building, where he arrived shortly before 11. He promptly telephoned Elite Flights, a company that chartered small jets with whom he had dealt previously, and he was relieved to discover that, fortuitously, they had an unbooked Lear available for departure at his convenience. He took the $25,000 from the secret compartment in the back of his bedroom closet. With the funds he had removed from the safe deposit boxes, he now had $150,000 in immediate operating capital, enough to deal with virtually any contingency that might arise. He hurriedly packed 3 suitcases, distributing a few clothes in each, but leaving most of the space for other items. He stowed away 2 handguns, a Smith & Wesson Model 19 Combat Magnum, chambered for the .357 Magnum cartridge, but also capable of firing .38 special cartridges with considerably less kick, and a .32 Beretta Model 70, its stubby barrel grooved to accept a screw-on pipe-type silencer, of which Jack included 2. He also took an Uzi submachine gun, which he'd illegally modified for full automatic fire, plus plenty of ammunition. Jack's newly acquired guilt had substantially transformed him during the past 48 hours, but it had not overwhelmed him to such an extent that he was incapable of dealing violently with those who might deal violently with him. His determination to be an honest and upstanding citizen did not interfere with his instinct for self-preservation, and considering his background, no one was better prepared to preserve himself than Jack Twist. Besides, after 8 years of alienation and loneliness, he had begun to rejoin society, had begun to hope for a normal life. He would not let anyone destroy what might be his last chance for happiness. He also packed the portable Slicks computer, which he had used to get through the armored transport's sophisticated electronic lock the night before last in Connecticut. In addition, he decided he might need a police lock release gun, a tool that could instantly open any type of pin tumbler lock, mushroom, spool, or regular, without damaging the mechanism, and which was sold only to law enforcement agencies, and a StarTron MK202A, a compact, handheld night vision device that could also be rifle-mounted, and a few other things. Although he distributed the heaviest weapons and equipment equally among the 3 large suitcases, none of the bags was light when he finally closed and locked them. Anyone who helped him with his luggage might wonder about the contents, but no one would ask embarrassing questions or raise an alarm. That was the advantage of leasing a Learjet for the journey. He would not be required to pass through airport security, and no one would inspect his baggage. From his apartment, he taxied to LaGuardia. The waiting Lear would take him to Salt Lake City, Utah, the nearest major airport to Elko, a shade closer than Reno International, and a lot closer if you considered the necessity of overflying to Reno and then doubling back in a conventional engine commuter plane to Elko. Elite Flights had told him that Reno was anticipating a major snowstorm that might close them down later in the day, and the same was true of the 2 smaller fields in southern Idaho that were capable of handling Lear-sized jets. But the weather forecast for Salt Lake City was good throughout the day. At Jack's request, Elite was already arranging the lease of a conventional engine plane from a Utah company to carry him from Salt Lake to the little county airport in Elko. Although it was in the easternmost fourth of Nevada, Elko was still within the Pacific time zone, so he would benefit from a gain of 3 hours, though he did not think he would arrive in Elko much before nightfall. That was all right. He'd need darkness for what he was planning. To Jack, the taunting postcards, retrieved from his safe deposit boxes, implied there were people in Nevada who had learned everything worth knowing about his criminal life. The card seemed to be saying that he could reach those people through the Tranquility Motel, or perhaps find them in residence there. The postcard was an invitation, or a summons. Either way, he could ignore it only at his peril. He did not know if he was being followed to LaGuardia. He did not bother looking for a tail. If his apartment phone was tapped, they knew he was coming the moment he called Elite Flights. He wanted them to see him approaching openly, for then they might be off guard when, on arrival in Elko, he suddenly shook loose of them and went underground. Monday morning, after breakfast, Dom and Ginger went into Elko to the offices of the Sentinel, the county's only newspaper. The biggest town in the county, Elko boasted a population of less than 10,000, so its newspaper's offices were not housed in a gleaming glass high-rise, but in a humble, one-story concrete block building on a quiet street. Like most papers, the Sentinel provided access to its back-issue files to anyone with legitimate research needs, though permission for the use of the files was granted judiciously. In spite of the financial success of his first novel, Dom still had difficulty identifying himself as a writer. To his own ears, he sounded pretentious and phony, though he realized his uneasiness was a holdover from his days as an excessively self-effacing milquetoast. The receptionist, Brenda Hennerling, did not recognize his name, but when he mentioned the title of his novel that Random House had just shipped to the stores, she said,
"It's the book club selection this month. You wrote it? Really?"
She had ordered it a month ago from the Literary Guild, and it had just arrived in the mail. She was, she said, an avid reader, 2 books a week, and it was truly a thrill to meet a genuine novelist. Her enthusiasm only added to Dom's embarrassment. He was of a mind with Robert Louis Stevenson, who had said, "The important thing is the tale, the well-told tale, not he who tells it." The Sentinel's back-issue files were kept in a narrow, windowless chamber. There were 2 desks with typewriters, a microfilm reader, a film of microfilm spools, and 6 tall filing cabinets with oversized drawers containing those editions of the newspaper that had not yet been transferred to film. The exposed concrete block walls were painted pale gray, and the acoustic tile ceiling was gray, too, and the fluorescent lights shed a cold glare. Dom had the odd sensation that they were in a submarine, far beneath the surface of the sea. After Brenda Hennerling explained the filing system to them and left them alone to do their work, Ginger said,
"I'm so caught up in our problems that I keep forgetting you're a famous author."
"So do I," Dom said, reading the labels on the filing cabinets that held issues of past Sentinels. "But of course I'm not famous."
"Soon will be. It's a shame. With all that's happening to us, you're getting no chance to savor the publication of your first novel."
He shrugged. "This isn't a picnic for any of us. You've had to put an entire medical career on hold."
"Yes, but now I know I'll be able to go back to medicine once we've dug to the bottom of this," Ginger said,
as if there was no doubt they would triumph over their enemies. By now, Dom knew that conviction and determination were as much a part of her as the blueness of her eyes.
"But this is your first book."
Dom had not yet recovered from his embarrassment at being treated like a celebrity by the receptionist. Now Ginger's kind comments kept a blush on his cheeks. However, this was not the mark of embarrassment. It was an indication of the intense pleasure he took in being the object of her concern. No woman had ever affected him as this one did. Together they went through the file drawers and removed the pertinent back issues of the Sentinel. They would not need to use the microfilm reader, for the newspaper was running 2 years behind in the transferal to film. They withdrew a full week's editions, beginning with Saturday, July 7th, of the summer before last, and took them to one of the desks, where they both pulled up chairs. Although the unremembered event that they had witnessed, and the possible contamination, and the closure of I-80 had happened on Friday night, July 6th, the Saturday paper carried no report of the toxic spill. The Sentinel was primarily a source of local and state news and, though it included some national and international material, was not interested in fast-breaking stories. Its holes would never ring with that dramatic cry, "Stop press!" There would be no last-minute recomposition of the front page. The pace of life in Elko County was rural, relaxed, sensible, and no one felt a burning need to be breathlessly up to the minute on anything. The Sentinel was put to bed late in the evening for distribution in the morning. Therefore, since no Sunday edition was published, the story of the toxic spill and the closure of I-80 did not appear until the edition of Monday, July 9th. But Monday's and Tuesday's editions were emblazoned with urgent headlines. Toxic spill closes I-80, and Army establishes quarantine zone, and nerve gas leaking from damaged truck? Question mark. And Army says everyone evacuated from danger zone, and where are evacuees? And Schenckfield Army testing rounds, what really goes on there? And I-80 closure enters fourth day? And cleanup almost finished, highway open by noon. For both Dom and Ginger, it was eerie to read about these events that had transpired during days when they remembered nothing more than relaxing quietly at the Tranquility Motel. As Dom read about the crisis, he became convinced Ginger's theory was correct. It seemed obvious that the mind-control technicians would have needed an extra week or two in order to have incorporated this elaborate toxic spill cover story into the phony memories of both Elko County locals and passers-through, and there was no way they could have kept the highway closed and the area sealed tight for that long. The edition of Wednesday, July 11th, continued the saga. I-80 opens, and quarantine removed, no long-term contamination, and first evacuees located, they saw nothing. Editions of the Sentinel, distinctly a small-town paper, averaged between 16 and 32 pages. During those days in July, most of its news space was given to reports of the toxic crisis, for this event had drawn reporters from all over the country, and the low-key Sentinel found itself at the center of a big story. Poring over that wealth of material, Dom and Ginger discovered a lot that was pertinent to their quest and that would help them plan their next move. For one thing, the degree of security imposed by the United States Army was soberly instructive of the lengths to which they would go to keep the lid on the truth. Although it was not strictly within their authority to do so, Army units attached to Schenckfield had established roadblocks and closed a 10-mile stretch of I-80 immediately after the accident. They had not even informed the Elko County Sheriff or the Nevada State Police of the crisis until they had secured the quarantine zone. That was a startling breach of standard procedure. Throughout the emergency, the sheriff and state police complained with increasing vehemence that the Army was freezing them out of every aspect of crisis management and usurping civilian authority. State and local police were neither included in the maintenance of the quarantine line nor consulted on essential contingency planning for the possibility that increased winds or other factors might spread the nerve gas beyond the initial area of danger. Clearly, the military trusted only its own people to keep the secret of what was actually happening in the quarantine zone. Following 2 days of frustration, Foster Hanks, the Elko County Sheriff, had complained to a Sentinel reporter that, "This here's my bailiwick, by God, and the people elected me to keep peace. This is no military dictatorship. If I don't get some cooperation from the Army, I'll see a judge first thing tomorrow and get a court order to make them respect the legal jurisdictions in this matter." The Tuesday Sentinel reported that Hanks had, indeed, gone before a judge, but before a determination could be made, the crisis was drawing to an end, and the argument about jurisdiction was moot. Huddling over the newspaper with Dom, Ginger said,
"So we don't have to worry that all authorities are aligned against us in this.
The state and local police weren't part of it. Our only adversary is..." "The United States Army," Dom finished, laughing at the unconscious element of graveyard humor in her assessment of the enemy. She also laughed sourly.
"Us against the Army? Even with state and local police out of the battle, it's hardly a fair match, is it?
According to the Sentinel, the Army kept sole and iron control of the roadblocks on I-80, the only east-west artery through forbidden territory, and also closed 8 miles of the north-south county road. Civilian air traffic was restricted from passing over the contaminated area, necessitating the rerouting of flights, while the Army maintained continuous helicopter patrols of the perimeter of the proscribed land. Obviously, substantial manpower was required to secure 80 square miles, but regardless of expense and difficulty, they were determined to stop anyone entering the danger zone on foot, on horseback, or in four-wheel drive vehicles. The choppers flew in daylight and after dark as well, sweeping the night with searchlights. Rumors circulated that teams of soldiers equipped with infrared surveillance gear were also patrolling the perimeter at night, looking for interlopers who might have slipped past the big chopper's searchlights.
"Nerve gas is rated among the deadliest substances known to man," Ginger said, as Dom turned a page of the newspaper they were currently perusing. "But even so, this much security seems excessive. Besides, though I'm no expert on chemical warfare, I can't believe any nerve gas would pose a threat at such a distance from a single point of release. I mean, according to the Army, it was only one cylinder of gas, not an enormous quantity.
Not a whole tanker truck, as Ernie and Faye remembered it. And it's the nature of gas to disperse, to expand upon release. So by the time the stuff spread a couple of miles, it would have been diluted to such a degree that surely the air would have contained no more of it than a few parts per billion. In 3 miles, not even one part per billion. Not enough to endanger anyone.
This supports your idea that it was biological contamination.
Possibly, Ginger said. It's too early to say. But it was certainly more serious than the nerve gas story they put out.
By Saturday, July 7th, less than 1 day after the interstate was closed, an alert wire service reporter had noted that the uniforms of many of the soldiers in the quarantine operation bore, in addition to rank and standard insignia, an unusual company patch, a black circle with an emerald-green star in the center. This was different from the markings on the uniforms of the men from Schenckfield testing grounds. Among those wearing the green star, the ratio of officers to enlisted men was high. When questioned, the Army identified the Green Star soldiers as a little-known, super-elite company of Special Forces troops.
"We call them DERO, D-E-R-O, which stands for Domestic Emergency Response Organization," an Army spokesman was quoted by the Sentinel. "The men of DERO are superbly trained, and they've all had extensive field experience in combat situations, and all of them carry top security clearances as well, which is essential, because they may find themselves operating in highly classified areas, witness to sensitive sites." Dom translated that to mean DERO men were chosen in part for their ability and willingness to keep their goddamn mouths shut. The Sentinel quoted the Army spokesman further. "They're the cream of our young career soldiers, so naturally many have attained the rank of at least sergeant by the time they qualify for DERO. Our intention is to create a superbly trained force to deal with extraordinary crises, such as terrorist attacks on domestic military installations, nuclear emergencies on bases housing atomic weapons, and other unusual problems. Not that there's any aspect of terrorism involved in this case, and there's no nuclear emergency here either. But several DERO companies are stationed around the country, and since one was near when this nerve gas situation arose, it seemed prudent to bring in the best we had to ensure public safety." He refused to tell reporters where this DERO company had been stationed, how far they had been flown, or how many were involved. "That's classified information." Not one of the DERO men would speak with any member of the press. Ginger grimaced and said, "Schmonses." Dom blinked. "Huh?"
"Their whole story," she said, leaning back in her chair and rolling her head from side to side to work out a cramp in her lovely neck. "It's all just schmonses."
"But, what's schmonses?"
"Oh, sorry. Yiddish word. Adapted from German, I guess. One of my father's favorites. It means something of no value, something foolish, absurd, nonsense, worthy of contempt or scorn. This stuff the army put out is just schmaltzes. She stopped rolling her head, leaned forward in her chair, and stabbed one finger at the newspaper. So this Giro team just happened to be hanging around here in the middle of nowhere precisely when this crisis arose, huh? Too damned neat.
Dom frowned.
But Ginger, according to these stories, although the roadblocks on I-80 were set up by men from Schenckfield, the Giro team took over little more than an hour later.
So if they didn't just happen to be nearby, the only way they could have gotten here so quickly was if they were airborne and on their way before the accident ever happened.
Exactly.
You're saying they knew in advance there'd be a toxic spill?
She sighed.
At most, I'm willing to accept a Giro team might have been at one of the nearest military bases, in western Utah or maybe up in southern Idaho. But even that's not near enough to make the Army scenario work. Even if they dropped everything and flew in here, the moment they heard about the spill, they couldn't have been manning those roadblocks within an hour. No way. So yeah, it sure looks to me as if they had a little advance warning that something was going to happen out at the western end of Elko County. Not much warning, mind you, not days, but maybe a 1 or 2 hour advance notice.
Which means the toxic spill couldn't have been an accident. In fact, probably wasn't a spill at all, neither chemical nor biological. So why in hell were they wearing decontamination suits when they were treating us?
Dom was frustrated by the elaborate maze of this mystery, which twisted and turned inward but not toward a solution, toward nothing but twistier and more complex pathways that led into ever deeper puzzlement. He had the irrational urge to tear the newspapers to shreds, as if by ripping them to pieces he would also be ripping apart the Army's lies and would somehow find the truth revealed, at last, in the resultant confetti. With a note of frustration that matched his own, Ginger said,
"The only reason the Army called in a Giro company to enforce the quarantine was because the men patrolling the zone would have a view of something highly classified, something absolutely top secret. The Army felt they couldn't trust ordinary soldiers who didn't have the very highest security clearance. That's the sole reason the Giro team was used."
"Because they could be trusted to keep their mouths shut."
"Yes. And if it had been nothing more than a toxic spill out there on I-80, the Giro men wouldn't have been required for the job. I mean, if it was just a spill, what would there have been to see? Except maybe an overturned truck and a damaged, leaking canister of gas or liquid."
Turning their attention once more to the newspaper spread before them, they found additional evidence indicating the Army had had at least some warning that unusual and spectacular trouble would erupt in western Elko County that hot July night. Both Dom and Ginger distinctly remembered that the Tranquility Grill had been filled with a strange sound and shaken by earthquake-like tremors about half an hour after full darkness had settled on the land. And because sunset came later during the summer, even at 41 degrees north latitude, the trouble must have started approximately at 8:10. Their memory blocks began at the same time, which further pinpointed the event. Yet Dom spotted a line in one of the Sentinel stories stating that the roadblocks on I-80 had been erected almost at 8 o'clock on the dot.
Ginger said, "You mean the Army had the highway closed off 5 or 10 minutes before the accidental toxic spill even happened?"
"Yeah. Unless we're wrong about the time of the sunset."
They checked the weather column in the July 6th edition of the Sentinel. It painted a more than adequate portrait of that fateful day. The high temperature had been expected to hit 90 degrees, with an overnight low of 64, humidity between 20% and 25%, clear skies, light to variable winds, and sunset at 7:31.
"Twilight's short out here," Dom said. 15 minutes, tops. Figure full darkness at 7:45. Now, even if we're wrong to think it was half an hour after nightfall that trouble hit, even if it came just 15 minutes after dark, the Army still
had its roadblocks up first.
So they knew what was coming.
But they couldn't stop it from happening.
Which means it must have been some process, some series of events that they initiated and then were unable to control.
Maybe, Tom said. But maybe not. Maybe they weren't really at fault. Until we know more, we're just speculating. No point to it. Ginger turned the page of the Sentinel's edition for Wednesday, July 11th, which they were currently examining, and her gasp of surprise directed Dom's attention to a head-and-shoulders photograph of a man in an Army officer's uniform and cap. Although Colonel Leland Falkirk had appeared in neither Dom's nor Ginger's dreams last night, they both recognized him at once because of the description that Ernie and Ned had supplied from their nightmares. Dark hair, graying at the temples, eyes with an eerie translucency, a beakish nose, thin lips, a face of flat, hard planes and sharp angles. Dom read the caption under the picture. Colonel Leland Falkirk, commanding officer of the company of Dero troops manning the quarantine line, has been an elusive target for reporters. This first photograph was obtained by Sentinel photographer Greg Lundy. Caught by surprise, Falkirk was angry about being photographed. His answers to the few questions asked of him were even shorter than the standard no comment. Dom might have smiled at the quiet humor in the last sentence of the caption, but Falkirk's stony visage chilled him. He instantly recognized the face, not only because of Ernie's and Ned's description, but because he had seen it before, the summer before last. Furthermore, there was a ferocity in that hawk-like countenance and in those predatory eyes that was dismaying. This man routinely got what he wanted. To be at his mercy was a frightening prospect. Staring at the photograph of Falkirk, Ginger softly said,
Kanenhar.
Aware of Dom's puzzlement, she said,
That's Yiddish, too. Kanenhar? It's an expression that's used to ward off the evil eye. Somehow it seemed appropriate.
Dom studied the photograph, half mesmerized by it. After a moment, he said,
Yes, quite appropriate.
Colonel Falkirk's sharply chiseled face and cold, pale eyes were so striking that it seemed as if he were alive within this photograph, as if he were returning their scrutiny. While Dom and Ginger were examining the back-issue files at the Elko Sentinel, Ernie and Fay Block were working in the office of the Tranquility Motel, trying to contact the people whose names were on the guest list for July 6th, two summers ago, but who had thus far been unreachable. They were behind the check-in counter, sitting opposite each other at the oak desk, which had knee holes on both sides. A pot of coffee stood within reach on an electric warming plate. Ernie composed a telegram to Gerald Salco, the man who had rented two rooms for his family on July 6th, the summer before last, and who was unreachable by phone because his number in Monterey, California was unlisted. Meanwhile, Fay went back through last year's guestbook, day by day, looking for the most recent entry for Cal Sharkle, the trucker who had stayed with them on that July 6th. Yesterday, Dom had tried the telephone number Cal had printed in the guest registry that night, but it had been disconnected. The hope was that a more recent entry would provide his new address and phone number. As they performed their separate tasks, Ernie was reminded of countless other times throughout their 31 years of marriage when they had sat facing each other at a desk or, more often, at a kitchen table. In one apartment or another, in one house or another, at one end of the world or another, from Quantico to Pendleton to Singapore, nearly everywhere the Marines sent him, the two of them had spent long evenings at a kitchen table, working or dreaming or worrying or happily planning together, often late into the night. Ernie was suddenly filled with poignant echoes of those thousands of huddled conferences and shared labors. How very fortunate he had been to find and marry Fay. Their lives were so inextricably linked that they might as well have been a single creature. If Colonel Falkirk or others resorted to murder to terminate this investigation, if anything happened to Fay, then Ernie hoped he would die too, simultaneously. He finished composing the telegram to Gerald Salco, called it in to Western Union, and requested immediate delivery, all the while warmed by a love that was strong enough to make their dangerous situation seem less threatening than it really was. Fay found five occasions during the past year when Cal Sharkle had stayed overnight, and in every case he had listed the same Evanston, Illinois, address and phone number that he had entered in the registry for July 6th of the previous year. Apparently he had not moved, after all. Yet when they dialed this number, they obtained the recording that Dom had gotten yesterday, informing them that the telephone had been disconnected and that no new Evanston listing existed. On the chance that Cal had moved out of Evanston into the Windy City itself, Fay dialed area code 312 information and asked if there was a number for Calvin Sharkle in Chicago. There was not. Using a map of Illinois, she and Ernie placed calls to information in the Chicago suburbs, Whiting, Hammond, Calumet City, Markham, Downers Grove, Oak Park, Oak Brook, Elmhurst, Des Plaines, Rolling Meadows, Arlington Heights, Skokie, Wilmette, Glencoe, no luck. Either Cal Sharkle had moved out of the Chicago area or had dropped off the face of the earth. While Fay and Ernie worked in the first floor office, Ned and Sandy Sarver were already preparing dinner in the kitchen upstairs. This evening, after Brendan Cronin arrived from Chicago, after Georgia Monotella and her little girl flew in from Vegas, there would be nine for dinner, and Ned did not want to leave preparations until the last minute. Yesterday, when all six of them joined forces to prepare and serve the evening meal, Ginger Weiss had observed that the occasion was almost like a family holiday gathering, and indeed, they felt an extraordinary closeness, though they hardly knew one another. With the idea that reinforcement of their special affection and camaraderie might give them strength to face whatever lay ahead of them, Ned and Sandy had decided that tonight's meal ought to be like a Thanksgiving feast. Therefore, they were preparing a 16-pound turkey, pecan stuffing, scalloped potatoes, baked corn, carrots with tarragon, pepper slaw, pumpkin pie, and made-from-scratch crescent rolls. As they chopped celery, diced onions, cubed bread, and grated cabbage, Ned occasionally wondered if what they were cooking was not only a family feast, but also the last hearty meal of the condemned. Each time that morbid thought rose, he chased it away by pausing to watch Sandy as she worked. She smiled almost constantly, and sometimes softly hummed a song. Surely an event that had induced this radical and wonderful change in Sandy could not ultimately culminate in their deaths. Surely they had nothing to worry about. Surely. After 3 hours at the Elko Sentinel, Ginger and Dom ate a light lunch, chef's salads, at a restaurant on Idaho Street, then returned to the Tranquility Motel at 2:30. Fay and Ernie were still in the office, which was filled with appetizing aromas drifting down from the apartment upstairs. Pumpkin, cinnamon, nutmeg, onions fried light